PharmaRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iPharmaRx. In today's podcast, we're going to talk about the recently released CHEST Guideline and Expert Panel Report regarding the use of antithrombotic therapy for the prevention of stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. Well, we posted on iPharmaRx a super brief summary of the top 10 things we believe every clinician should know about these guidelines, written by Kristen Reeser and Dylan Lindsay. Joining me today for the iPharmaRx podcast is Dr. Lindsay. Dr. Lindsay is a clinical pharmacy specialist in the Coordinated Care Clinic with Cigna HealthSpring in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. So, Dylan, it's great to have you with us here today to talk about the management of antithrombotic therapy in patients with atrial fibrillation and the new CHEST guidelines.
Thank you, Stuart. It's great to be back with i4MRX.
So before we get started and talk specifically about the recommendations in the new CHEST guidelines, I'm wondering if you can give us an assessment of the quality of the guideline development process. Back in 2011, the Institute of Medicine published a set of recommendations to guide the development and reporting of clinical practice guidelines in a report that was entitled Clinical Practice Guidelines We Can Trust. It's sort of like a guideline for guidelines, if you will. And in that report, they outlined 8 standards that all clinical practice guidelines should try to meet. And these standards include recommendations about conflicts of interest and transparency, who should be on the guideline development group, how the systematic review should be conducted, and how the evidence should be rated, just to name a few. So how well does this guideline stack up against those standards? Is this a high quality guideline, or is this largely an expert consensus opinion report?
I think in general, an attempt was made by the guideline authors to at least acknowledge the standards outlined by the Institute of Medicine, though there are still numerous shortcomings that need to be highlighted. For example, to your point about transparency, the authors do specifically indicate that funding for this update was provided internally by the American College of Chest Physicians, and the methods section of the guidelines do provide some information related to panel composition and member selection, but the majority of panelists listed as authors on this set of guidelines are MDs or PhDs, so there's not much in the way of diversity of other healthcare providers or even patients being represented as a part of this process. And the actual criteria for panelist selection are not provided. The authors simply state that panelists were nominated by the guideline chairperson. We should also note that according to the supplementary conflict of interest document, only 4 of the 12 authors reported no potential conflicts of interest. And of those who did report a conflict, only 1 is denoted as recusing themselves from voting on a particular topic or recommendation. Similar concerns are noted in regards to the systematic review process, with the authors providing specific search terms and dates utilized, but any additional criteria for inclusion or exclusion of the data identified by these searches are not provided. In terms of the recommendations actually put forth by the update, a grading scale is included and utilized for each recommendation made, but readers will note that a majority of the recommendations are categorized as either weak with low quality evidence for support, or they're simply ungraded consensus-based statements. To put a more concrete number to it, over 1/3 of the 60 recommendations included in this update are actually ungraded consensus-based statements. With all that in mind, I wouldn't say this is a high quality guideline based on the Institute of Medicine standards, but a complete reduction to expert consensus report might be a bit of an overstep as well.
So Dylan, I know you and Dr. Reeser had some time to read and digest the entire guidelines, all 125 pages of the text plus 50 pages of tables and supplemental material. What were some of the recommendations that really jumped out at you, perhaps surprised you a bit, and why?
Well, although there were several notable changes made in this iteration of the guidelines, I did think one of the biggest things that's going to jump out at any reader is the dethroning of warfarin, so to speak, in patients that are likely to do equally well on a direct oral anticoagulant. this change may not necessarily be surprising to some from a practicality standpoint, as the direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, have grown in popularity since the initial FDA approval of dabigatran back in 2010. And they certainly do have their appeal, especially for patients that are likely to be non-adherent to scheduled INR checks, consistent weekly consumption of vitamin K, or who are on complicated or actively shifting medication regimens where drug interactions are more likely to cause an acute change in INR. That being said, though, I do think it's important to note that warfarin still has its place as a viable treatment option, especially when you take into account that many, if not all, of the DOACs may be cost prohibitive for the patient. The other thing that seemed to be a prevailing theme to me in this update was a shift to a more conservative approach to treatment in certain circumstances. With the CHADS-VASc scoring system, for example, we now see a shift away from categorizing patients as low, moderate, or high risk. Rather, the CHADS-VASc scoring system is now recommended to determine if a patient should be offered a stroke preventative or not. We also see different recommendations provided for CHADS-VASc use based on gender, with men still qualifying for stroke prevention with a score greater than or equal to 1, while women now don't receive the same consideration until their score is greater than or equal to 2. We see a similarly conservative shift in the recommended use of antiplatelet agents for stroke prevention, now relegated predominantly only to patients with a compelling indication for their use, such as acute coronary syndrome or post-stent placement.
So, as you point out, there's been a shift in recent years away from using warfarin and towards using the non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants, or sometimes called the direct oral anticoagulants, DOACs or NOACs, for stroke prevention in patients with atrial fibrillation. And this trend is largely based on randomized controlled trials that document some safety and efficacy advantages, as well as the convenience of the DOACs when compared to warfarin therapy. Some have argued, though, that most of these trials were comparing the DOACs to suboptimal warfarin therapy management, and that warfarin really is a better choice for many patients, particularly if the INR can be maintained in a therapeutic range at least 65% of the time or more. The guidelines now suggest using the same TTR scoring system to predict who is and who isn't a good candidate for warfarin therapy. So can you tell us a little bit about this scoring system, the same TTR, and its predictive value?
Yes. So as you've already stated, the same TTR system is a scoring system that was developed mainly to assist in predicting whether a given patient is likely to do well on warfarin therapy, which the guideline authors define as a time in therapeutic range, or TTR, of 65% or more. Patients receive points for the presence of risk factors that are believed to increase time out of that therapeutic range for various reasons, such as medication non-adherence, interactions that may affect the mechanism of warfarin, a patient's inability to receive evaluation or necessary warfarin dose adjustments on a regular basis, etc. The same portion of the scoring system refers to the patient's sex, age, and medical history, while the TTR references the patient's current treatment regimen, tobacco use, and race. A score greater than or equal to 2 is associated with decreased likelihood of maintaining a time in therapeutic range for 65% of the time or greater, which would require the patient to have more frequent INR checks, more frequent follow-ups in general, and more frequent education to improve their understanding of those factors that affect their ability to maintain a desirable INR while on warfarin. To date, the same TTR system has been evaluated in 15 different atrial fibrillation cohorts, though we should note that the study population in most of these cohorts were predominantly Caucasian patients over the age of 65, so there might be some concern that same TTR is less predictive in minority patients or patients that are younger. I think it's also important to highlight that to date, this scoring system has mainly been studied in the setting of atrial fibrillation, so there are some efforts currently undergoing its evaluating its usefulness in the setting of venous thromboembolism, with current data suggesting that it may hold similar predictive value in those patients as well. However, as things currently stand, same TTR is only recommended for use as a predictive tool in the setting of AFib.
So Dylan, given the recommendations in this guideline, how do you see your practice changing? What are some of the things you have already done over the past month since these guidelines were published? And what do you think will be some of the more difficult recommendations to achieve or follow?
Well, working in a clinic that caters specifically to Medicare patients, maintaining lower healthcare costs is a large part of our decision-making process, particularly since most of our patients are retired and now on a fixed income. Couple that with the fact that a large part of the patient population in South Mississippi is rural and medically underserved, and we've got a bit of a balancing act that needs to be maintained. Our patients may not be able to afford the cost of constant travel and lab copays for INR checks while on warfarin, and may also exhibit poor medication adherence with a complex warfarin regimen as they begin to develop memory issues. So from that perspective, the DOACs offer the appeal of little to no lab monitoring, as well as a fixed dosing regimen with fewer drug interactions in general. However, patients frequently can't afford these medications outright due to their higher tier copays and plan deductibles. For this reason, we routinely screen patients for eligibility to apply for the low-income subsidy program through Social Security, as well as manufacturer patient assistance programs. With the update to the CHEST guidelines, we've seen an increased interest in converting patients from an existing warfarin regimen to one of the DOAC medications, which has created several opportunities for provider education related to available assistance programs to help mitigate costs to the patient, as well as information surrounding approved FDA indications for each individual DOAC, as well as appropriate conversion from warfarin based on the patient's most recent INR.
Dylan, I want to thank you for your insights about the new CHEST guideline and the expert panel report regarding the use of antithrombotic therapy for atrial fibrillation and stroke prevention. No doubt these guidelines will have an impact on all of our practices for the next few years, and some of the recommendations have created a little bit of a buzz. We'd love to hear from you about what you think about the new guidelines. Are there recommendations that you believe are long overdue? Are there recommendations you think lack sufficient evidence? And are there recommendations you think will be misinterpreted, misconstrued, and misused? Well, let us know what you think by posting a comment or two. Remember, only iFormerX members can post comments and use the other interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormerX. It's free. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX, signing off.